This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
It's Wednesday, May 8th, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. The House Committee on Energy and Commerce held a hearing on, quote, accusations of ideological bias at NPR. It wasn't an unbiased hearing. It wasn't exactly a murderer's row of witnesses. No one from NPR showed up, and the experts who did were all the invitees of the Republicans on the committee. Now, you know I've been critical of NPR's content and programming. My interest being MNPR, you know, make NPR great again, or at least sensible. As far as federal funding, I think the local stations definitely need it, though I'm a little ambivalent about it. I'm a little ambivalent about if NPR might be better off just issuing federal money, and then they can escape charges of bias. You know, no private news organization would ever be subject to a congressional hearing, even if its head declined to attend. And by the way, the NPR president, she has been on the job a very short time, and she had only 1 week notice for this hearing. And this was the day of her first actual board meeting, which really should have been a priority. So you got to wonder if Congress really wanted to facilitate Catherine Morris' testimony or just bludgeon her for not testifying. There was a series of witnesses all making similar points, such as, even if you like it, why should I have to pay for it? It's clearly biased, is NPR's programming. I would have loved for anyone to have been asked, all right, take that standard you just articulated. Why should I have to pay for it? Why should I have to pay for opinions or news with which I disagree? And apply that to the library. U.S. Congress funds the Library of Congress, your town, our constituencies, all of many libraries. Why should any library be funded? Isn't it full of ideas that are wrong or one-sided or unfair? I mean, every local library has the Bible and also Richard Dawkins' God Delusion. They are incompatible texts. One of them's wrong. Most libraries have Rush Limbaugh's The Way Things Ought to Be and Al Franken's Rush Limbaugh's a Big Fat Idiot and Other Observations. Again, clashing ideologies. There were a few interesting moments that defied partisanship. Ben Guthrie, Republican of Kentucky, spoke highly about his local public radio affiliate.
Because when I look at this, I have WKYU's Western Kentucky affiliated public radio and their television station as well. And I know the journalists on there, they work hard. I don't always agree with the way they cover me, but I absolutely think they do it in a fair way. Sometimes the stories they do that are fair. And I think that's the judge. If they're always biased against you, that's one thing. If they cover you in a positive way sometimes, in a negative way, and sometimes that's just fair. And so I view it that way.
Scott Peters, a Democrat from the San Diego area, said NPR really should look at itself. If so many people find bias, don't write off the idea that there could not possibly be bias.
And I mean, this is from a lot of news outlets. I see a real point of view, and I see that on the right and left. Some of them don't apologize for it. I mean, Fox News and Newsmax, they know what they're about. Others do it without admitting it. But with respect to NPR, you've got serious criticisms out there about objectivity that I think need to be met. I think what we talk about diversity ought to be diversity of opinion, ought to be a diversity of political opinion. I think that's a legitimate question.
Peters asked for leadership to bring about credibility and think hard about perceptions that people have, that they might be on one side or another. I think that's useful. It's hard to think that any real change, any change at all, will come from this hearing. This hearing is itself a biased process. I'm a little torn. I mean, Congress is not supposed to be nonpartisan. So the question is, can an explicitly biased body be tasked with identifying the bias in others and also maybe defunding that bias? Probably not, but also probably not a threat. Let's return to the realm of the practical. The committee room was half empty. C-SPAN 1, C-SPAN 2, C-SPAN 3, C-SPAN the Ocho, none of them even carried this hearing. Is C-SPAN biased? No. Like me, after I found and watch the whole thing. Maybe they're just a little bored. On the show today, full-blown famine is a full-blown exaggeration in Gaza. But first, we continue our conversation with Brody Mullins, co-author of The Wolves of K Street, The Secret History of How Big Money Took Over Big Government. Today, we continue the conversation talking about Paul Manafort, extremism, and how to keep lobbyists in check. Brody Mullins up next. A lot of times when you hear about VPNs, I find that they just assume you know what they are, or even if you have an understanding, oh, they're a virtual private network, you might not know the acronym, but in general, don't they mask what you do online? Why do I need that? People don't explain it correctly, and it was explained to me when I got into the beneficial aspects of Surfshark. So a VPN does mask what you do online, and that's really important for some people who, might be trying to be a dissident in an oppressive regime. It's also just important in terms of general hygiene for why do you have to let every advertiser and everyone else know where you were and, you know, follow your tracks. But I find it's also very practical. Like I said, it's a mask. And so a mask does hide identity, but a mask, a well-fitted N95 mask, also might protect you, which is what a VPN does too. Practically, however, in my life, there are many websites that when I'm traveling, I can access. I have and pay for access to them. Then I find myself in as far-flung a place as Canada. Sometimes, as an American, a foreign version of, say, Netflix would come in handy. I'd like to watch some of those shows, and I'm not just talking about Czechoslovak soap operas. I'm talking about how the excellent movies move in and out of the different Netflix in different localities with a really good VPN like Surfshark. You could access all of them. And another big one for me is there is a major broadcaster in Britain. It is a broadcasting company there, but they don't let me hear all the stuff that someone there can hear with a VPN. I could listen to that as if I were there. There are so many practical uses, plus the traditional use of why let them know exactly what you're doing. Your surfing is for you. A VPN allows you to surf what you want to surf, where you want to surf, without interference from, let's say, repressive governments or the Czech Netflix regime. Get Surfshark VPN at surfshark.deals/gist. What are those deals? Well, enter promo code GIST for 3 extra months for free. You heard me right. 3 extra months for free. That's surfshark.deals/gist.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Brody Mullins is one of the authors of The Wolves of K Street, The Secret History of How Big Money Took Over Big Government. And my first question was about Paul Manafort, who I remember when he joined the Trump campaign in 2016, the campaign was seen as rudderless. So they go out, they get Paul Manafort, and he's described as, oh, the fellow who ran Gerald Ford's campaign. Well, that seemed like an odd and old credential, but that's how it was described. He then, quite famously, after the Ford ordeal, and you talk about this in your book, he infamously went overseas. He became a big consultant. Ukrainians hired him left and right. The question is, was this because he was essentially forced out of the good graces of Washington, or did he just see the riches of the nascent democracies of Eastern Europe as a better business opportunity?
It's a little bit of both, but I think what happened with Paul Manafort is that he just started hanging out with and seeing people with more and more money, and he just got drawn to the money. So at first he represented, you know, smaller companies in Washington, and he would hang out with, their CEOs, and he saw, you know, business money, which is, you know, it's millions of dollars. But then he started doing business with some overseas folks, and he started meeting foreign dictators who were making billions of dollars, and he just sort of who's incredibly attracted to that lifestyle, that instead of going to, you know, vacation in the Hamptons, he needed to go to Saint-Tropez. You know, he sort of went from big time U.S. money to big time global money, and he never looked back.
Yeah, he enjoyed the feel of the ostrich skin jacket, which was a detail in one of his adjudications. Now, what happened to Stone? I mean, we know what happened to Stone. He seems to just revel in being a rapscallion, but after he built up his name and reputation in this firm for good or ill, but very successfully, what did he do from, I know he was involved in some New York campaigns, but he always showed up as, like I say, a fringe figure. And if you didn't know it, you wouldn't know how powerful he was. Trace what he did in the wilderness between his big successful lobbying firm and getting associated with the Trump campaign.
Yeah, he's almost like the Forrest Gump of that firm and of lobbying. He sort of, and of Washington politics, he sort of shows up from time to time in various important places. You're never quite sure why how or why he got there. He was on the 1996 Bob Dole campaign. And during that campaign, someone found a classified ad that he and his wife ran looking for couples to swing with. And, you know, when the Dole campaign said, "Hey, is this you?" he admitted it and was fired. He was also in the middle of some scandals in New York. He's sort of been on the leading edge of the sort of conservative Tea Party movement. He makes lots of money getting paid speeches there. But he sort of had left kind of mainstream corporate America lobbying world. He didn't really work as closely as a lobbyist for companies as some of his other partners at the firm did. He was a little more extreme and outside of the norm.
And Charlie Black, who is the more genteel face of the firm, he stayed as a consultant and, if not a lobbyist, then he stayed as a Washington power player who, unlike Stone and Manafort, wanted to, I think, avoid scrutiny and legal entanglements.
Yeah, Charlie Black, I think, always wanted to run a good, upstanding, reputable corporate lobbying firm. And when those four were together in the early 1990s, there was a lot of tension because Manafort and Stone wanted to go represent these foreign governments and make tons of money and fly all around the world and represent causes and foreign government officials who were pretty sketchy, yeah. Warlords at times. But, you know, warlords have a lot of money and they were drawn to that.
That's
money.
The Lord portion, you know, yeah.
Right. Charlie Black didn't want to do that. He wanted to represent mainstream U.S. corporations and was sort of more risk averse. Yeah. So the firm ended up splitting at that point because Black wanted to go mainstream and the other two wanted to go outside mainstream.
To the extent that they had discernible politics, would you say Blacks were more moderate than the other two guys?
Absolutely. I think they started off all on the outside of mainstream. I mean, remember, go back to Reagan. Reagan was not the mainstream candidate during that 1980 election. He was running against George Bush Sr., who was the old school country club Republican,
right.
Yale.
And beforehand, Reagan was the guy who tried to crash Ford's party and almost did it. But it was Manafort who was helping Ford, fend off the forces of Reagan.
Exactly.
In 76.
So it's just hard to remember Reagan is not a mainstream Republican, but right. He wasn't. So all four of them were also not mainstream Republicans. They were more extremists, which really helped them. But once they took power, Black wanted to become the establishment and did become the establishment. Whereas the other two kept sort of resisting and wanted to throw bombs from the outside.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's a personality thing or an actual politics thing?
That's a great question. I think it's personality. Black is Black is a churchgoer. He's a book reader. He's a devout Christian. He probably joined the country club and in his younger days, played golf or tennis. The other two guys are just wanting to blow things up.
Yeah. Did you talk to any of the three of them?
Yes, we spoke to Charlie Black extensively, who was very helpful, and the other two, no surprise, did not want anything to do with us.
I want to go back to some of the macro picture, and this idea that in the 1960s, government was but a fraction of where it is now. And then, I think what a critic would say, the regulatory state took control, and there were many regulations. And before this era of regulations, maybe why the Chamber of Commerce went along with Nixon, there were politics at play, but because the Monongahela was on fire, and it was pretty clear that in this era, we had this boom post-World War II, but we had very few business regulations, and it really wasn't working out for everyone. So we needed regulations. But then, maybe you could make the point that we did get overregulated. I know in the Wall Street Journal, they chronicle this idea almost every day. And if you look at the codes and the regulations and compare it, the number of regulations and had one chart, just to, I don't know how you would chronicle it. Maybe a good measure is, you know, the number of pages in the, what is it? The
Federal Registry.
Yeah, the number of pages in the Federal Registry. That's one thing they always say. So you look at that chart and it's a hockey stick and it's going up, up, up. And then if you look at the rise of lobbying money, it's following it, but not really even keeping pace. So putting aside the excesses of the lobbyist, how distasteful it seems, the particulars of the characters that you portray, would you say there is some sort of push and pull logic that says the lobbyists actually have their roles and there's something to be said for using them, corporations needing to use them, or else they'll get regulated to death?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And, you know, to be clear, we're not saying that corporate lobbying is bad. What we're saying, and as we said, you know, it's a regulated industry. It's an industry that's protected by the First Amendment. Everyone is allowed to petition their government. The problem we have now is that because unions are not strong, because consumer groups are not strong, because environmentalist groups are not strong as used to be, that companies are the only ones putting their thumb on the scale. There's something like, you know, 100 lobbyists for every one member of Congress. I said before that we talked to lobbyists who say that they don't even deal with labor unions. There's no other side. So members of Congress are only getting one viewpoint, and that's the viewpoint of corporate America, which sometimes is right and sometimes is wrong, but there's no one giving the other point of view. And that's really kind of where the problem comes in. But I think also from a corporate point of view, you're right. The government is incredibly powerful. It's incredibly complex. And if you're a good business person, you focus on your business. You don't focus on Washington and focus on regulations. So when it's time, so when there's a regulation or a policy that could hurt your business, you need to hire someone else to do that. You need to sort of outsource that. A corporate CEO can't spend all their time in Washington fighting regulations or their company will go haywire because they're not managing their company. So that's really kind of what lobbyists do, is they're sort of like the outsourced side of the government relations arm of companies.
Yeah. And another way to look at it, you had the shockingly big figure that, what, $450 million was spent on lobbying or made by lobbyists?
I don't remember that figure, but one of the things we found is that there's the registered lobbying side. These are the lobbyists who are paid to go talk to members of Congress. And that's about a billion dollar industry. But there's another side of it, which is lobbyists who are doing polling and are doing focus groups and are out in the states trying to rally consumers and rally individuals to write their members of Congress. That side of the industry is far, far bigger. It's not regulated at all. So no one knows who these people are. No one knows how much money they're spending. No one even knows who they represent. And that's a big unknown area.
Do you think a major factor in the votes or positions of most members of Congress are lobbyists?
Absolutely. I mean, think of it this way. I was working on a story last year and found this stunning. During the last presidential election, Democrats, Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren talked nonstop about rolling back the Trump tax cut, the big corporate tax cuts of 2017 that lowered the corporate rate. And it was, you know, trillions and trillions of dollars. Democrats talked nonstop in that last election about rolling that back. After that last election, we had a Democrat, Joe Biden as president. We had Democrats running the House and the Senate. And there was never even a vote on rolling back those taxes. It's not like they had a vote to roll back the taxes and lost. There was never even a vote.
Right.
That's how much money, that's how much power corporations have over Congress.
So you think that that was mostly a corporate consideration, that they got, if not bribed, they knew the corporate interests would help their campaign donate money to them? See, I look at that and say they thought it was a political non-starter. They thought it would, maybe Elizabeth Warren wouldn't agree with this, but they just see what happens if you vote to raise taxes, even if it's a, you know, more equitable distribution of taxes or a progressive instead of regressive tax. It's just bad politics. You don't need a lobbyist to tell you that.
Yeah, you know, I think that the number one thing that a member of Congress does, the number one thing they think about every day is how to get reelected. And they will not vote for things that will get them tossed out of office. And in this case, they looked at these corporate tax cuts and they thought, if I vote against these tax cuts, I'm going to lose. Whether that's because corporations give them money or because their employees would vote against them or not vote for them. You know, either way, Democrats did not hold a vote on those big corporate tax cuts, which, again, I just find stunning.
Yeah. What about, and I see that you've been writing about a figure, Lina Khan, who is the new, or she's been in as FTC commissioner since the administration began, and she's had some big losses. But recently, for instance, the FTC, who knows if it'll hold up, they struck out against non-compete clauses. You even wrote an article about how some Republicans are fans of hers. A couple questions there. One is, can such a figure, a singular figure, and I know we're drawn to characters as storytellers, but can such a singular figure have a big impact? And the second part of the question is she such a figure, if the answer is yes?
That's another good question. I mean, she definitely represents a movement. I mean, she didn't come up with this idea on her own. Again, the idea here is that she believes the U.S. has not been properly enforcing antitrust rules and laws, and that the U.S. government has allowed companies to grow and merge and to combine and get way too big and powerful and influential. And she believes that the original antitrust laws that are now 100 years old simply need to be better enforced. That's a viewpoint that both Republicans and Democrats had sort of been against for 80 years or so. We sort of let companies get bigger. Both Republicans and Democrats have said that, you know, U.S. companies need to get bigger and combine in order to compete with overseas companies. Now there's sort of there's a little bit more of a momentum on the other side that she is involved with and she is leading. But if she were to go away, that movement would still exist. I don't know who would become the figurehead for it. But what's interesting to me is that it's both Republicans and Democrats who believe that these companies have gotten too big, and it's the government's job to try to rein them in. Okay, you know, Democrats have always said it's the government's job to rein in companies. What's fascinating to me is that now some Republicans are saying that, and some of the most conservative Republicans out there, Matt Gaetz, Josh Hawley, these guys are saying, you know what, I agree with Lina Khan, this big liberal Democrat, that these companies have gotten too big, and the U.S. government should be given more power to rein in companies. That's extraordinary to me.
So you pointed out in this interview and in the book that the countervailing force to keep lobbyists in check are labor unions or environmental groups. Now, there's a lot of attention and I guess momentum for those causes, but a lot of it is not what I would call deeply rooted. They're very popular tweets, or they're sort of identities that one can loosely wear, or, you know, a person can genuinely identify themselves as an environmentalist or aligned with the labor union, sympathetic to the labor union. But the question is that the same? It's not the same, but how close is it to when there really were bona fide workers in the AFL-CIO in the House, as opposed to three young people living together in an apartment who would tell a pollster they're in favor of unions but aren't in unions themselves? And the same thing for when there were really robust, or if there are really robust, environmental groups versus cheering on actions that get a lot of attention but maybe aren't as deeply rooted as, say, the Sierra Club was.
Yeah, I think that's a real issue right now. I feel like there are a lot of people, a lot of Americans, maybe not a majority, but huge numbers of Americans who are against the growth of companies, who would push back, but are just not organized. Labor unions are an organized force that are getting smaller. I feel like at some point, someone's going to come along and figure out a way to pull all these Americans together, and they're going to be a really powerful force. But right now, they're sort of kind of all over the place. A good example is, you know, because I think that these people have more power together than they have sort of, not organized. A good example is...
So you're saying the People United will never be defeated.
I think that's the case, especially, you know, at a time when companies seem to have all this power. Companies are organized. So think about the 2017 election when Donald Trump won. Every company, almost every company, was against Donald Trump. The Washington establishment, the political class, everyone thought Trump was terrible and didn't want to win. And he won because the people supported him. You know, a lot of people don't like Donald Trump, but like democracy won in that moment. They lost in the next election. But, you know, he was able to pull together disenfranchise people around the country to win that election. And that just shows to me, it's not about Donald Trump, what it shows to me is that the people have that power to overcome big entrenched Washington and corporate interests, but they need to be organized. And right now they're not organized.
Is big tech the same kind of lobbyists as all the other businesses, but with a zero behind it?
Yes and no. The yes part is that, you know, they have a lot more money. The biggest lobbying forces in Washington are now those five big companies. And they have almost every lobbyist on their payroll. And if you look at the top donors to Joe Biden's campaign, boom, it's all five of those companies again. What's different is that they have a way of communicating, you know, through the internet and through their communication systems to their users and to employees and to Americans that other companies have. So let's say
that other companies don't. Right.
That other companies don't. Sorry. So let's say ExxonMobil wants to, raise, change fuel efficiency standards or something. How do they get out to people? They have to run ads or write letters to people or who knows. These companies just, you know, can tap into their networks of millions of users in a second.
Yeah. And I've seen it work and I've seen it not. I mean, TikTok tried it and it looks like, who knows if it'll fight a court challenge. But the TikTok, I'm not going to call it sale, the forced sale is not going to be stopped by the millions of TikTok teens berating members of Congress, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's the best example. A few months ago, or maybe a few weeks ago, TikTok went out to some of its users and said, hey, Congress is trying to ban us, you know, call your member of Congress. And some of them did. And the members of Congress got upset by that.
Yeah.
Like, don't have your users call us.
Yeah.
So that example should have worked, but failed.
Yeah. Are there other countries that do it better?
You know, one of the fascinating things we found out in doing this research is that other countries don't have a lobbying community, which is sort of stunning to us, that no other country has a sort of K Street, has a place where all companies, you know, hire lobbyists and give campaign donations and try to push on behalf of companies. I mean, there's certainly some corporate interests overseas, you know, in London, the EU, but a lot of those companies are US companies also, where, you know, the tech companies see increasing regulation in the US and increasing regulation in the EU, and they send their US lobbyists over to the EU to push back.
Yeah.
So lobbying, for some crazy reason, I don't know the answer, is a uniquely American institution.
Are any states doing it better? I know some are doing it worse. Some have no rules.
Well, you know, interestingly, one thing that companies are figuring out is that because the US Congress gets so little done, that something they can do is now go lobby state governments. So, you know, if you take California, Texas, Florida, and New York, and you get what you want in those four states, you've got 50% of the population covered. There's tons of lobbying going on in the states, and it could be even worse for companies, because if there's not much scrutiny on what companies are doing in Washington, you know, how much scrutiny are they getting in Albany or Sacramento? You know, I mean, way less.
Brody Mullins, along with his brother Luke, who writes for Politico, is the author of The Wolves of K Street. Brody is an investigative reporter for The Wall Street Journal, and he was part of a team that won the 2023 Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting, revealing financial conflicts of interest among officials at agencies that bought and sold stocks that they were tasked with regulating. You know, that chicanery, though deep and Pulitzer worthy, doesn't even make this 600-page book. What I'm saying is it's a rich target area for Brody to cover. Thanks so much, Brody.
Thanks for having me. This is great.
This episode is brought to you by The Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about The Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where it got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying, unflattering things about the war effort and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And now the spiel. With all else going on in Gaza, we now get this terrible news. I'll quote some headlines. AP, the UN says there is, quote, full-blown famine in northern Gaza. What does this mean? ABC, breaking news, northern Gaza experiencing, quote, full-blown famine. UN official, meaning source to UN official. New York Times, parts of Gaza in, quote, full-blown famine, UN aid official says. Now, those headlines don't tell you who the UN aid official is or even which agency. At least USA Today narrows it down on the last score. Headline, World Food Program Director, parts of Gaza in, quote, full-blown famine. If you want to get even more specific, I'll play the clip of the UN official, the World Food Program Director, saying these exact words.
Well, whenever you have conflict like this and emotions rage high and things happen in a war, famine happens. And so what I can explain to you is that there is famine, full-blown famine in the north, and it's moving its way south.
You might not be able to place the voice, but if you saw her, I think you'd know she's an extremely famous American and one whose expertise in the area of international diplomacy and heading major UN agencies dates back to, well, about 2.5 years ago. Here is Katie Couric talking about this United Nations official in the year 2008.
She has pretty eyes. They're freaking me out a little. No, she looks like a husky.
No, she looks.
You know those weird blue eyes?
Like,
huh?
Yeah.
Like, are we not blows out?
Cindy McCain has the most intense eyes. They're like light ice blue. And she had a purple suit on, and I mean, they were so intense. I was like, I couldn't stop staring at her.
Yes, it's Cindy McCain, appointed to Joe Biden to be the U.S.'s ambassador to the U.N. Food Agency as a thank you for all the campaigning she did against Donald Trump, who criticized her late husband, John McCain. Cindy McCain was then elevated to the World Food Program Executive Director position 1 year and 3 days ago. As a political spouse and someone who ran nonprofits, she has intelligence, instincts, and a good heart. I really think she does. What she doesn't have is a deep knowledge of the designations of international famine. The UN uses a baroque and politically negotiated process of designating situations as famines, and they use metrics like 30% of the children have to be suffering from acute malnutrition or wasting, or proportion of the population who's starving, or deaths of 2 adults or 4 children per every 10,000 people dying daily. Of course, these are all human-made designations. What's a famine? A famine means lots of people are starving to death. All evidence is that in Israel, a lot of people, hundreds of thousands of people, are malnourished, need food, maybe worse than that. In some cases, certainly worse than that. But Cindy McCain just jumped to the worst possible designation. The media all ran with it. The intentions may be good. Let us get attention and let's get more aid into the area. But I'm here to tell you that the consequences may be bad. An erroneous declaration of famine undermines credibility. Plus, a formal declaration could be used as evidence at the ICC and the ICJ, International Criminal Court, International Court of Justice. And an informal fly-by-the-seat-of-your-pants, just-say-it-to-say-it declaration of famine just upsets people who demand that such evidence be introduced when it can't because it's not proper evidence. Now, an actual spokesman for the WFP, the World Food Program, Shaza Moghrabi, last week described the situation with these words.
As you've said, we've had the IPCC report, which is the gold standard for food security analysis and malnutrition analysis, come out in March, warning of looming famine, particularly in the northern parts of Gaza, if the situation doesn't change and we don't get the access, WFP and the humanitarian actors and players do not get the access that they need to reach people, particularly in the north where the situation is most dire. Now, as you said, we have seen some modest improvements in recent days and recent weeks when it comes to access, particularly in the northern areas.
She went on to say, quote, in order to reverse the trajectory of moving towards famine, we need routes to be open all the time. Routes, a reference to border crossings that had been open and had been permitting a record number of trucks to come in. Of course, now with the Rafah operation, some of the crossings have been closed, the Israelis say temporarily. We should also say that a temporary seaport being constructed by the United States is about, I mean, right on the cusp of, by the time you hear this, this may have already occurred. It's about to achieve full functionality. But overall, that's not going to have a huge impact. And everything we're looking at is not a happy picture. I'm not here to tell you that it is. It is not overall positive. It is nowhere near totally reassuring as an assessment. But I'll also tell you what it is not. Right now, a famine or a full-blown famine. We are just going by the actual definition that the actual UN agency uses, the definition which they themselves refer to, you just heard it, as the gold standard. I guess you could ask, well, it's important. It's very important in this situation. More important than it's ever been in other situations, which is just not true, and ignores the hundreds to million, and ignores the hundreds of thousands of people who actually have experienced a full-blown famine, or what would be called a Category 5 famine conditions. But you could say, all right, maybe we should just ignore the gold standard. Maybe we should just ignore standards. Maybe we should just say full-blown famine if saying so makes it more likely for aid to get in. But there are many reasons not to do this. Many reasons even beyond what I think is the good enough reason, which is it's just not true. Why have gold standards or standards at all if a well-intentioned, lovely, kind-hearted, incautious non-expert just blows through the standards and the definitions and says, I guess, what kind-hearted people all over the world want to hear. Why not just do that? And some reasons that I could think of include accuracy, resource allocation, giving permission to ignore standards in all future conflicts, degrading the credibility of the organization, hurting not just participants in this conflict, but everyone else if a degraded organization were to pronounce or mispronounce a famine there, and especially in this case, provoking the ire of the only real player in the conflict who could do anything about the starvation, near starvation, horrific humanitarian situation on the ground, even if it's not yet a full-blown famine. So you might hate Israel. You might just hate what Israel's doing. You might put all the moral culpability on Israel and none on Hamas for the suffering. Or maybe you have a more nuanced calculation, 70-30, 50-50. Doesn't matter. The fact is, Israel's a member of the United Nations. Israel's a signatory to all the relevant decrees in this area. They might not like it. They might not like being in the United Nations or adhering to what the United Nations says. They might say United Nations, shmunited nations, but they are part of the international committee. I mean, that's why they send judges and lawyers to sit on and argue their case in front of the ICJ, because they recognize the legitimacy of the body. Not because Israel is nice, but because they're like every other country in the world. They do so out of self-interest, mutual self-interest. Sure, fine. And it's same with adhering to the United Nations World Food Program, which is the world's largest humanitarian organization. That program has definitions. And members of the UN, in adherence to that program, will say, we will adhere to the definitions. The definitions are not only accurate, but are in place for a reason. If we violate the definitions, ignore them, then the organization, the World Food Program, the UN itself, will just give up its standing. If you just change the definitions, lower the standards, lead with your heart, use lay definitions, legitimacy is lost. So mine isn't a legalistic or rhetorical objection. It's actually a plea for process. It's an explanation of why the rules should be followed. It's very hard to create and impose rules for law. But to the extent that that's possible, it helps no one to throw the definitions and rules away in the service of getting the most important party involved to actually follow the rules. And that's it for today's show. Corey Warr is the Gist's producer. Joel Patterson's the Gist's senior producer. Michelle Pesca is in charge of special projects for the productions that are Peachfish. The advertising arm of The Gist is Libsyn, Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. The advertisements you hear, they have fostered this exchange. Go to advertisecast.com/thegist for more. Oompru Jeepru Doopru, and thanks for listening.